The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic. And before we continue our journey, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. So with that in mind, let's continue as we take a look at today's Armchair Traveler. We're going to have a couple of more articles from the 2024 special issue of National Geographic. You've been following the program recently. You know about these. This special issue is titled Indigenous Futures, and these articles are telling us how indigenous communities around the globe are seeking to reestablish cultural approaches supporting conservation with models of innovation and sustainability. Now, our first article is going to be written by Aroha Awawu. It's more than words. From the New Zealand area, we're going to learn how a Māori model for teaching language has shown communities across the world a way to reclaim and rebuild their cultures. Now, we're going to be trying to say some of these Māori words, so I will warn you. So bear with me, because this is definitely a language not found around North Carolina, but nonetheless one that's important to our culture and to the world and to these people. And that's what this story is about. So let us begin, okay? Well, 5 years ago, in the heart of the Kenyan Kikwa Nation along the Canadian St. Lawrence River across from Montreal, Kenantokan Hemlock and Irene Hinatwa Tatum, Macomber, or Macomber in some cases, but we're going to use Macomber, which I believe is correct, pondered a question posed by their friend and mentor, Maori language advocate Sir Timotei Kurotu. Now, Kinan Keha, the Mohawk language, is one of the world's many endangered indigenous languages. Over the past two decades, Macomber, Bear Clan, and Hemlock of the Bear Clan have been part of a community effort to operate an immersive language school which surrounds Mohawk students with fluent language speakers. As she put together plans for the school at the turn of the 21st century, Macomber looked around the world for inspiration and forged relationships with others who have successfully rekindled their languages. There might not be anyone as well versed in this endeavor as the man who sat across from Macomber, Hemlock, and a group of Kininkahai speakers in their school's kitchen table. Karatu's question for them was straightforward. What was their dream for the future of the language? More time to study the intricacies of Kinankeha with the nation's first language speakers. Now mostly elders, said Macomber, or Macomber. Karatu, Nai Kahunganu, Nai Tuhu leaned back. Well, you had all this time with them already. Has it helped? He asked. Well, yes, but not enough, not yet. Elders were aging, and young speakers still have much to learn. What they needed was greater urgency. Hemlock says this was a very, very Sir Timotei kind of response. Direct and considered expectational and instructive. Macomber, the founder and teacher of 10 years and counting at the Language Nest School in Kinankekeha, says that from their first meeting with Karatu in 2019, his guidance and drive have motivated her and her fellow Kinankeha speakers. Now, don't wait for money, don't wait for anyone's approval, and don't wait for anyone to jump on board, Macomber says. Just do the work. It's the same language, the same message Karatu and his cohorts carried with them 6 decades ago when Te Reo Māori, the Māori language, was approaching endangered status. And it's the same message he preaches today as he travels to indigenous communities across the world with a delegation of Te Reo speakers and teachers. His words carry the weight of hope because of what Māori organizers accomplished and built and what others have been able to build with their blueprint. Now, just to kind of set the record straight geographically, Māori, of course, is an Aboriginal group out of Australia. And, of course, Mohawk would be in Canada and North America. So just to give you kind of a perspective here, just so we don't get too confused. Now we continue with our article. In the early 1970s, a contingent of young urban and university-educated Maori began to form a movement in Aotearoa, the Te Reo word for New Zealand. Now, these activists called themselves Ngāi Tomatoa, or Young Warriors. Along with other regional groups, they organized against the New Zealand government's marginalization and forced assimilation of Maori communities, starting with policies designed to stem the use of te reo Maori. In 1867, New Zealand passed the Native Schools Act, outlawing the use of te reo in schools. Teachers and school administrators beat students who dared to speak their mother tongue. Those abused Maori children became Maori parents trying to protect their own children from the same fate. Many discouraged the use of the Maori language, first in public and then at home. The number of native speakers dwindled, and the language was at risk of being lost. Everything during that period was learning how to be a colonizer, says Time Ite, a renowned Maori activist and artist who joined Ngāi Tomatoa when he was 17. In 1972, Ngāi Tuhu Wakoto Te Arawa and fellow Ngāi Tomatoa members marched with the Te Reo Māori Society to the steps of the New Zealand Parliament in Wellington. The contingent carried a petition, signed by more than 30,000 people, that called for Māori to be taught in all public schools. The highly visible nature of the protest, it believes, imbued Māori communities across the Aotearoa with the confidence to reclaim te reo Māori. Now, Dame Iratena Tawawi Rerangi was a founder and instrumental leader of the movement's first major success, Kohanga Reo. Opened in 1982, Kohanga Reo model was one of commitment. Parents and toddlers were expected to speak only te reo, both in the classroom and at home, and the curriculum focused solely on Māori history and culture. Elders and other proficient language speakers led the classes. Translated in English to Language Nest, the Kohanga Reo was the first program of its kind to use language and cultural immersion. For Māori communities, the schools were a revelation. According to Tawi Rirarangi, Ngāi Pāru Ngāti Kahanganu Napoli, the program started with 5 schools and within 3 years expanded to more than 300 locations. The rapid spread of Kohanga Reo marked an unprecedented success of cultural reclamation. For Tawiri Rirarangi, it showed the widespread pent-up desire Maori families felt to educate their children according to their own non-colonial standards. The families on the ground are fundamentally the basis for learning the language, she says. Kohanga Reo in the first years it flew. Why did it fly? Well, not because I was there with a teaching background, not because of Timotei. By the way, Timotei can be pronounced in English Timothy, but I'm trying to be as close to the native pronunciation as I can. The difference maker, she says, was that Kohanga Reo, particularly in the early years, were entirely community-led. Families raised the money to rent or buy classroom spaces, and volunteers planned and taught classes. The New Zealand government was intentionally uninvolved in curriculum and oversight. At the early nurturing stage in particular, Tairi Rerangi says language starts at home. Urunai Kapara was born in 1983, right as the movement to revitalize Te Reo took off. Her parents and grandparents helped start the local Kohanga Reo, one of the first to open in Aotearoa. Now, Kapara and her classmates were taught to speak Māori all the time, everywhere, no matter what, she says. As a child, Kapara, Ngāi Awa Tuho, Tu Waratoa, Ngāi Rangatiti, did not understand that she was part of a movement, or that her class was, as she says, the guinea pigs. They were just Maori kids with Maori teachers and administrators. Our grandparents ruled, our parents ruled, she says. They just really wanted to instill in us the beauty of our language, our culture, and who we are. Maori families soon recognized the work could not begin and end with the Kohanga Reo. In 1985, Kapara's Corner of Aotearoa, a group of Maori elders and educators, founded the Te Kura Kupapa Maori, or Hooni Watiti, the first Teo immersion school for primary school students. Meanwhile, a contingent that included the Tararangi and Karatu, who was appointed a Maori language commissioner in 1987, organized the passage of the Maori Language Act, which gave Te Reo Maori official status alongside English and later New Zealand Sign Language. As Kapara grew up within the new Maori-led school system, she says she learned the responsibility she and her classmates shared, both to Maori them and to their parents and grandparents for the sacrifices they had made. In 2021, Kapara became the first news broadcasters with a moko kuai, a traditional chin tattoo, to host primetime news. Kupapa has given me this cool way of being confident, standing comfortably in front of people and publicly speaking, reading the news in English as well as in Maori, she says, navigating two completely different worlds with ease. The language nest model quickly became one of the Maoridom's most important exports for indigenous communities worldwide. Around the same time as young Kapara was in Kahangareo, native Hawaiian language advocates were beginning to address language loss. In 1982, Maori language scholar Tamati Reedy traveled to Hawaii for a lecture and to spread word of the newly established Kahangareo. Within 2 years, a small group led by Larry Kamara, now a professor of Hawaiian language and Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, set up the first language nest schools in Hawaii called Aha Punana Leo. The following year, they opened a language nest school in Hilo and another in Honolulu. 4 decades on, the Aha Punana Leo system includes 13 preschools across Hawaii. Organizers and administrators have also opened a series of primary and secondary immersion schools. Like the Kahangareo, the Aha Punana Leo became a beacon when McComber was researching how to operate the Kenenkeha language nest. She traveled to Hawaii to learn how they adjusted the Maori model to fit their cultural needs. We wouldn't have been able to get where we are without the support of other indigenous peoples who are doing the work, Hemlock says. We've always needed each other. From the Poliwup tribe in Washington State to the Sami in Finland, indigenous communities have begun to follow the example set by the Maori language nest 6 decades ago. As Kamara notes, the act of mastering one's own language extends beyond learning a new set of words and phrases. It allows communities to view and understand the world as their ancestors and keeps their way of life alive and well for the generations to come. It's not just language, she says. It's everything. So they are a very interesting model of how indigenous languages are being reclaimed and being retaught to new generations. Well, our next article is also from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic. This is Ancient Practice, Future Promise, written by Rosemary P. Wardley. Now, her article is about a blueprint for sustainability that's being discovered in the indigenous Hawaii Moku and Ahupua system of land stewardship. So let's learn a little more. This is a very brief article, but it has some interesting facts that I think you'll enjoy. For centuries, the islands of the Hawaiian archipelago were divided into self-sustaining communities called Ahupua. Though through collective stewardship, they provided people with food, building material, and other basic and cultural necessities. The thriving system, however, was dismantled over the 20th century with the rise of the Western practice of private land ownership and the growth of the plantation economy. Today, facing a changing climate and strained resources, Hawaiians on several islands are working to revive this indigenous practice. Lewan, a descendant of one of the original families from a still largely intact Awapua on the island of Kauai, says that combining the toolkit of today with ancient systems will help her community keep their Ahupua as environmentally sound as our ancestors once did. Now, there's a beautiful graphic that we don't really have a lot of time here to describe, but it's basically one of the key islands, and it talks about Ahupua and how they break it up into regions and different things. And there's all kinds of facts and figures that go with this. It's a topographic map of different elevations and so forth. But there are some side notes that I'd like to share. First, from sky to sea, and Awapua is part of a larger system called Moku that divided each island into pie-shaped ecoregions. And the people of the Haina Awapua on Kauai fought to regain many stewardship rights over recent decades, and today 92% of the area is intact. Pictured in this graphic, as it would have been in the mid-1800s, this Awapua's traditionally functioned in part to support an institution of higher learning at a temple overlooking the sea. And then we have innovations in the Awapua. Haina, one of the few remaining of the more than 1,800 Awapuas that once existed, is at the vanguard of mixing technology with indigenous techniques. And they've got four examples. Gardener drones, attached robotic arms, allow scientists to collect samples and seeds from rare native species along steep cliffs. And when my wife and I were visiting Hawaii in 2017, we saw an example of this in one of our tours of one of the farms and former plantation areas. And using drones and seed planting, they were learning to grow a taro, you know, a potato-like vegetable that's grown with water and along very soggy soils. It's very interesting work to follow these people. Co-managed fishery is our next category. The local community determines appropriate catch levels and partners with the state to manage marine resources. Another example is prepping for extremes, growing a diverse mix of native plants along stream beds, and this is what I was just referring to, and across forest reduces the effects of increased flooding, landslides, and wildfire. Then we have finally sustainable tourism. Visitor numbers are limited, as is access to the most fragile parts of the ecosystem. So you might say there's kind of a cap on tourism in order to control these things. So there you go, another example of indigenous reclamation and conservation. We'll have more in from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic in a future episode of Armchair Traveler. Well, next we're going to head to Canada. Now, writer Elaine Glusak is going to take us from Nova Scotia to Montreal, driving solo and on a budget in a relocation RV rental. This article appeared in the August 16th, 2024 issue of the New York Times. Ms. Glusak also has a column called The Frugal Traveler, and we've had some of those in past episodes as well. When rental companies need to move their vehicles, they frequently offer one-way trips at a steep discount. Our frugal traveler snapped up a deal that took her through eastern Canada. That's how the editors describe what we're about to read, so I wanted to share that with you. And by the way, as we said, she, in her column, focuses on budget-friendly tips and journeys. Now, here's the article. Quebec City was designed to be imposing. On a steep hill above the St. Lawrence Seaway, behind 17th century ramparts, the city streets are narrow and cobbled, no place for road-hogging, 21st century recreational vehicle. Or so I thought as I planned an ambitious solo RV trip across eastern Canada from Halifax, Nova Scotia to Montreal, that would take me through one of the oldest European cities in North America. Colonial streets weren't my only mental roadblock when I set out in May to take advantage of a six-night relocation deal on an RV rental for $39 Canadian a night, and that's about $28 then, U.S., from the Canadian company Canadream. Its trips normally start at $136 nightly. When RV companies need to move their vehicles to satisfy seasonal demand, they frequently offer relocation or one-way trips at discounted prices. The RV rental company Cruise America calls them one-way specials, which recently included 75% off a trip in July from Las Vegas to Orlando. One-way sales from El Monte RV recently listed departures from 30 to 90% off. Based in Calgary, Canadream shuffles its fleet among seven locations in Canada. With relocation itineraries, the company stipulates the vehicle and departure and arrival dates. Renters pay for gas, food, and campsite access in addition to the discounted vehicle. Travel by RV took off during the pandemic as North Americans discovered the convenience and privacy of taking a home on the road. As someone who makes a living traveling light, I consider that style of travel freighted, sluggish, and spontaneity-sapping. What I got over six nights and nearly 800 miles on my maiden RV journey was an adventure in driving, a test of self-sufficiency, and an introduction to slow-lane travel. And there's a photo that accompanies the article at this point that kind of informs us about how this RV rental thing works. The Calgary-based Canadream Rental Company shuffles its RV fleet among seven locations across Canada, often relying on travelers to do the driving. Renters pay for gas, campsite access, in addition to the discounted vehicle. So there you go. Now we have some driver's ed in the next section. Before setting foot in Halifax, I had watched a video about my vehicle, the 22-foot-long deluxe van camper, introducing the many indicators that monitor electricity, waste, and water. My sense of responsibility only grew when I got the keys and set out on my journey. While small for an RV, the two-person deluxe van camper was taller, longer, and less nimble than camper vans I'd driven in the past, which you might expect from a vehicle that you can comfortably stand upright in, its interior height 6 feet 3 inches. Well, the apartment on wheels contained a bathroom with a hose extension on the faucet that doubled as a shower head, a galley kitchen with a microwave stove and small refrigerator, and a sofa in the back that converted into a firm queen bed. Storage areas, cabinets, and drawers contained removable window shades and amenities that seemed essential to me, namely bedding, towels, and kitchenware, which cost $175. A roof hatch and ceiling fan kept air circulating overnight. Setting out after stops for food and drinking water — the water on board is not potable — I was immediately met by what I came to consider the RV symphony, a soundtrack of clattering dishes and tinkling utensils punctuated by the squeak of wood cabinets. Aware of the extra space needed to break in an RV, I drove like an A student fresh out of driver's training, distant from vehicles ahead, going under the speed limit, and when it was time to park, picking remote, traffic-free spots. Though I would become more comfortable driving with each passing day, my pace was deliberate as I stuck to my instinct to never drive more than 90 minutes straight. Sightseeing breaks relieved the concentration required of driving. Now we have next some tidal adventures. Over the first 2 days, I started the Bay of Fundy, where the highest — I skirted the Bay of Fundy, where the highest tides in the world vary up to 53 feet. A few hours from Halifax, I followed the signs to Joggins Fossil Cliffs, and by the way, this is free, a UNESCO World Heritage Site where tides have exposed the fossil remains of a 300-million-year-old forest along cliffs roughly 100 feet high. Crossing into New Brunswick, I continued along the north shore of the bay to a campsite at Ponderosa Pines Campground. This cost $70. Now, its neighbors, Hopewell Rocks Provincial Park, and one of the province's biggest attractions, it has tide-carved sea stacks there. Now, my quiet lakeside campsite, like all the RV parks I visited, included power and water hookups, a fire ring, and a picnic table. In the morning, awakened by honking Canadian geese, I took a mile-long forest trail from the campground to Hopewell Rocks. The admission here was $15.85. High tide peaked just before the park opened at 9 a.m., surrounding the park's more than 20 freestanding sea stacks, monoliths that had eroded from the mainland cliffs and water. As the tide rapidly receded, a park interpreter pointed out the resemblance of the rock profiles to humans. "There are a lot of native legends of people turned to stone," he said, echoing the indigenous Mi'kmaq legend in which an angry whale transformed runaway slaves into rock. From Hopewell Rocks, a rural half-hour drive past barns and fields en route to Shoreside Alma, just outside of Fundy National Park. Tiny Alma has a string of restaurants near its working marina. At Alma Lobster Shop, I savored a briny lobster roll and seafood chowder combo, $29, from a bayside picnic table near sun-bleached whale bones. With about 3 hours to visit Fundy National Park, the admission $9, I stopped at the ranger station for advice on a speed tour. The staff seemed accustomed to the question, sending me first to Dixon Falls Trail to hike a nearly mile-long loop through a lush fern-filled gully split by the stone-carving cascade. Farther down on shore, I followed the pine-shaded Shiphaven Trail along an estuary where shipwrights once built schooners on a gravel bar. Back in the RV, I settled in for a 2-hour drive, punctuated by a few bird-watching stops, to my next campsite in the provincial capital of Fredericton. On the St. John River, Hart Island RV Resort was quiet in spring, its waters park still awaiting warmer weather, $60, by the way, for the fee here. Several riverside sites away, my closest neighbors were a pair of backpacking cyclists from England. I stoked a campfire with dried leaves and watched diving ospreys, soaring eagles, and paddling loons as the temperatures dropped with the sunset. Local encounters. A former British garrison, Fredericton is filled with intriguing 19th-century buildings that made me long for a ride that was a bit more agile on city streets. But I braved them the next morning to hit the city's renowned Fredericton Boyce Farmers Market at 7 a.m. when parking was available. The weekly Saturday event draws more than 200 vendors of everything from local produce to food truck samosas. The most provisioning of the trip turned up aged cheddar from neighboring Prince Edward Island for $10 and a loaf of sourdough for $8 and spinach pies, $2 each, from a Lebanese vendor. Before leaving town, I arranged to meet Cecilia Brooks and Anthony Brooks, a mother and son team who guide forest walks with an indigenous point of view through their company, the Wabanaki Tree Spirit Tours, for $60. We met at Odell Park, a 400-acre swath of old-growth forest just minutes from downtown, and began by burning small amounts of sweetgrass in homage to the giant hemlocks, some of which are over 400 years old. We meandered through the forest for more than 2 hours, stopping to discuss plants and fungi that were there first used by First Nations people as medicine or food, and to sample the balsam fir tea and homemade acorn cookies that Ms. Brooks, who is also a Mohawk and a Waslatukik, toted along in a basket. The elders say the Creator gave us everything we need, she says. Quebec plugged and unplugged. In the Riviera des Loups, in the south shore of the St. Lawrence, a seasonal Christmas castle and its giant Santa sculpture came between my site at Camp Duque for $39 and the water. In search of better views, I joined locals in camp chairs awaiting sunset at Parc de la Pointe, in Boulderfield Beach Park, 30-minute walk down to the shore. The next morning, I topped off the water tank and made the drive over 2 hours with a short break in Quebec City and Bassin-Louis RV parking. I reached a public lot in Old Port near the city walls by skirting the traffic-knotted center of town. And Bassin-Louis offers boondocking or RV camping without services like electricity and water. As a woman sleeping in a vehicle in a city, I closed the window shades for the duration, and so did the occupants of dozens of RVs and vans around me. And with that, we're going to leave today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed this one and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice, all one word, .org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.